We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Righty. Diving head first to this week's articles and events and news, starting with City Council.
Yeah, some City Council news this week. The City Council voted 7-1 to clarify the rules for rent repayment plans for renters who couldn't pay rent during the pandemic. Formerly, the council had passed an ordinance that said that renters must be offered reasonable repayment plans by landlords that would allow renters to pay back their back rent owing over the course of 3 to 6 months. The new law now says that renters must be offered plans with monthly installments that don't exceed 1/3 of their current monthly rent. For unpaid rent incurred up to 6 months after the city's civil emergency order expired. That order was ended by Mayor Bruce Harrell in February. So this city council is hearing from renters who are still unable to pay their rent. And it is, you know, a couple months now, past 2 to 3 months now, past the time when the city's civil emergency ended.
Yeah, I have a friend who, is delinquent on his rent because he's been unemployed for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And, he got an eviction notice the 1st of April. And he's been waiting for like months and months for assistance from that program. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't get an answer. He tried bugging city council people. He tried, he had to push a lot of buttons to even get any kind of a response at all. He got no response at all from Harrell's office. He's very assertive. He's, mm-hmm. he's a guy who has worked as a lobbyist. So he knows where to go. But even somebody with those kind of skills has not been able to get a straight answer. You know, everybody he talks to gives him a different answer.
So yeah, and the city council. I think the city council ran out of funding for the rent relief program a while ago.
Yes, as did the county.
So getting money to help with that is practically impossible at this point. So the city council is basically saying, look, you know, there isn't money to cover everybody. So what we're going to do is require landlords to offer people the reasonable repayment plan, and the back rent can be not just through February when the mayor ended the city's civil emergency, but now it can be through 6 months after the end of the civil emergency. So it's to cover folks like your friend who could be getting eviction notices and could end up on the street.
Right.
Now, Dan Strauss was the sponsor of the bill, and he characterized it as a correction to the city's law to bring it into compliance with state law. The only person on the council, I should also say up front that Shama Sawant was absent from the council this week. So she was not there to vote on the bill. But the only person to vote against it was freshman council member Sarah Nelson. And I should point out that even Alex Peterson and Deborah Juarez, who tend to support business-friendly legislation, voted for it because, you know, bringing city law into alignment with state law tends to provide clarity for businesses like landlords, right? And it protects the city from lawsuits. So I'm just saying there that Sarah Nelson, who said, you know, this could be very bad for small landlords. Maybe she ought to talk to her other council members who tend to favor business interests.
I don't get the impression, and I could be totally wrong. I don't know her personally. But just off public statements, I don't get the impression that she's the brightest person on council.
Yeah, and that was my impression of her on the campaign trail. I was impressed with her cognitive skills on the campaign trail.
Yeah.
So I'm not surprised that it's taking her an unusually long amount of time to get up to speed on some of this stuff and to learn that a key function of your job is caucusing with the folks on the council who have more experience than you and who align with your interests. She appears to lack that skill and to not understand that that's a key part of her job. Now, Nelson is also a member of the Public Safety and Human Services Committee, and that committee met this week. And in that committee, Nelson proposed a kind of surprise resolution to lift the city council's hold on $4.5 million of funding for the Seattle Police Department. Now, this came after the Seattle Police Department released their proposed hiring figures for 2022, which show that they won't meet their overly ambitious hiring goals. No surprise there. And that they'll end up with about 4.1 to 4.5 million in unspent salaries. So they basically said, well, during the budget process last year, we told you we were going to hire 125 officers this year. It's going to be more like 98 at the most.
And we were saying on this show at that time that does not sound realistic.
Oh, yeah. And so did Teresa Mosqueda during the budget process. And so did Lisa Herbold, who is the chair of the Public Safety Committee that oversees the Seattle Police Department. And so they proposed this budget proviso or hold on unspent salaries at SPD if they weren't able to hit that 125 new hires target. So that salary savings couldn't just be reallocated by the Seattle Police Department and spent on whatever they want, which is what they've been doing in the past. Nelson, however, wants to lift the hold on that funding so that SPD can, you know, spend the money wherever they want or on hiring bonuses for new personnel, even though two previous programs that had offered hiring bonuses didn't really have the intended effect of drawing more new hires to the department. But, you know, I mean, Nelson's kind of bought into the right-wing rhetoric, just, you know, give the SPD all the money they want so that they can spend it on whatever they want, and let's not exercise any oversight over them.
I don't really think SPD is the most responsible steward of taxpayer money. Just saying.
Yeah. Now, the mayor's office, so it would be useful before a city council member proposes something like that to ask the mayor's office, hey, what do you think, you know, since you directly oversee the day-to-day operations of the Seattle Police Department, where do you think that $4.5 million should go, you know, and work with me here and I can propose a resolution that has your support, right? That's what a lot of other city council members do. But the mayor's office hasn't asked the city council, you know, but it's not what Sarah Nelson did. And I need to point out that the mayor's office has not asked any city council members to fund hiring bonuses for the Seattle Police Department. Instead, Harold's office is asking all city departments to identify cuts that they can make to fill an estimated $150 million budget hole that is expected for the 2023 budget. Remember, and we talked about this, I think, just last week, that there are two big one-time revenue sources in the current city budget. That's the proceeds from the Mercer Mega Block sale and a big chunk of federal COVID-19 relief funds. Those funds are not going to be there next year, and the Harrell administration knows that. So once again, Nelson is way out of the loop. Lisa Herbold, on the other hand, has a separate proposal. She's proposing that the council lift the proviso on about $650,000 of unspent salary savings in the Seattle Police Department so that they can spend money on hiring a professional recruiter to help. And I have to ask, yeah, why haven't they done this yet? You know?
That seems like a really basic step, wouldn't you think?
Yes, I mean, exactly.
Especially for a specialized job like law enforcement.
Uh-huh,
you know,
uh-huh.
You need someone like that. I'm sure there's, you know, all kinds of resources out there.
Right. And then the other thing, and these are things that was something that was recently specifically requested by the Harrell administration. And then the other thing that the money would be spent on is to reimburse new officers for their moving expenses, which is a pretty common practice for the corporate realm when you're hiring specialized workers and you need to bring people in from out of town to fill holes. You often offer to pay their moving expenses if they need to move to Seattle in order to fill the job. So, I mean, that's not as common right now with people working remotely in industries where you can have remote workers, but it's very common when you have to have people actually in person doing the job on the ground, like a Seattle police officer. So that's actually a well-informed and an example of how Sarah Nelson should be crafting her legislation by talking to the people directly involved, whether it's people within the police department or whether it's the mayor's office, and coming up with an idea of what's actually needed before you just make a proposal.
Yeah, didn't we just have a candidate for Seattle Public Libraries, a finalist who had been chief librarian in Minnesota, who had been telecommuting for a year from his home in California?
he was working remotely, and he didn't tell anyone that, oh, by the way, I have moved to California. It wasn't until he'd been doing the job for a year that he said, oh, by the way, I'm not actually in Minnesota anymore. I moved to California. So kind of surprise. As an employer that you want to hear a year after the fact.
At least the climate was better in the rare occasions when he goes outside.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of makes you wonder what the circumstances were when that came up. Maybe let's all get together and discuss this.
Yeah.
particular problem. And then you hear from your chief librarian, oh, by the way, I'm living in California now.
Yeah. I won't be at the office party. Sorry.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm not going to be there at that critical meeting. Unless you pay my flight expenses and my hotel.
So
just saying. Anyway, other city council news. The city council is going to hold a public meeting this coming week on the pay up council bill 120294, which is the proposed legislation that would guarantee a minimum pay rate for app-based workers in Seattle. There's a whole bunch of amendments that have been proposed to that bill, and I would urge people to go on the City Council website and do a quick search for Council Bill 120294, read some of the action on that legislation so far, take a look at some of those amendments, and give your feedback on them, because some of the amendments from a quick, I just did a cursory look at them this week, and it looks to me like some of them would weaken the bill quite a bit, lower the pay rate for app-based workers. And it's really important to understand that a lot of folks who try to make a living off of doing this app-based work, like, delivering food, for example, or working for Uber or Lyft et cetera.
So
just struggle to make even minimum wage.
So it also goes by the term gig workers, I think.
Gig workers, yeah.
Yeah.
The description of the bill calls it app-based workers.
Okay, that was the first time I'd heard that. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I hadn't heard it either.
We are so behind.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes when you say gig workers, people think, are you talking about Microsoft employees? Are you talking about Amazon employees? Don't they make a ton of money? You know, so the app-based worker designation is actually a little more precise and really tells you who it is that's being covered by the bill.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Other city council related news? I know Carolyn.
One more city council, actually not really city council, but city related news. Carolyn Bick of the South Seattle Emerald, she's one of the reporters that I follow and that I really like. She had an article that was posted on their site just yesterday afternoon that said that Seattle City Attorney Ann Davison's office asked the Seattle Human Rights Commission not to seek friend of the court status right after the commission voted to actually do it on April 7th. This is part of the police reform process. They discussed and voted on a proposal for the Seattle Human Rights Commission to step in and do some of the things that the Community Police Commission has not been doing in terms of explaining to Judge James Robart's court that the Seattle police reform process has not been working very well for many people in the city of Seattle. And the CPC has not been doing what many folks think they should be doing in terms of investigating complaints and really pushing for policy changes with the court. So the Seattle Human Rights Commission is trying to get involved. The emails and copies of the agendas and meeting minutes that Carolyn Bick looked at seem to indicate that the city attorney's office may have asked the Seattle Human Rights Commission to cease and desist and may have threatened them with some kind of direct or indirect, it's not clear what was going on, legal consequences if the Seattle Human Rights Commission hired a pro bono attorney to prepare any filings for Judge Robart's court. And this all appears to have been done in secret because members of the committee discussed ways to make public the pressure that they were getting from the city attorney's office. Bick, of course, can't get copies of any of the direct communications between the city attorney's office and the Seattle Human Rights Commission because she was told that those are part of attorney-client privilege. And the city attorney's office, part of their role in city government is to act as the attorney and representative of city agencies. But as part of the police reform process, their main role is to represent the city of Seattle, who is a party to the lawsuit in Judge James Robart's court. When another city agency wants to step in as a friend of the court or as a separate party in the lawsuit, as, for example, the Community Police Commission did, they have to go through the city attorney's office and say, hey, you know, we want to hire an outside lawyer. Can you sign off that this would be a conflict of interest for you to do it so that then we can go and get funding for an outside attorney? And apparently it was in that process that the city attorney's office came back to them and said, no, we don't want you doing this, and then communicated some other things that may have been, we don't know for sure, and Bick doesn't know for sure because we can't get access to that, to the direct communications between the two, may have been a threat of some kind of legal consequences. Just putting that out there for people to be aware of. Bick thinks that it's a violation of the First Amendment that she can't get copies of these communications. I don't know if that's true or not, but it would be interesting to find out when and if they do release those communications, what they actually were and who in the city attorney's office communicated that to them.
Yeah, it's not uncommon for communications or documents related to or stamped as being attorney-client privilege when one does public records requests to
be withheld.
And to encounter that pretty regularly. However, I can tell you from having personally done that multiple times before that it sure sets the radar off every time it comes up.
Yeah, yep, exactly. Sure. You get that sense when you read Bick's article that, whoa, yeah. And she points out, she lists some of the wording there that kind of raised a red flag for her. And it looks to me like there may have been some sort of additional legal sanctions mentioned there or legal risks mentioned in that communication that, maybe was not something that Pete Holmes's city attorney office would have tried to pile onto the Seattle Human Rights Commission.
It makes you wonder what other city agencies are getting, you know, muzzled
from that
otherwise.
Office.
Yeah, mm-hmm. done secretly under the guise of attorney-client privilege.
Yeah.
And so I just like to, I mean, we've always, or not always, but of late have been recently touting the brilliance of Carolyn Bick's writing, but would just like to point out to people who work at or know people that work at the city that if they wanted to be a whistleblower and push relevant documents or information to Carolyn Bick, she is a very trustworthy individual and would protect your
and her email and Twitter account are right at the beginning of every article. So go for it.
Yeah, you just go over to the South Seattle Emerald website.
Yep, you'll find her.
Yeah.
South Seattle Emerald also happens to have a new executive director as of this week. Michael McPherson, who is former director of Veterans for Peace National Office and produces a monthly show here on KODX. So there you go.
Nice.
We don't know if he's going to continue doing the show now that he's got his new position, but we'll find that out, I suspect, in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah. That'd be good to know. Okay. Well, congratulations to him.
Yes.
The Emerald is a great community resource.
Great choice.
Yeah, and full disclosure, I write for them occasionally as well.
All right. So moving on, are we done with city council-related news?
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
There is a social housing initiative that is getting signatures as
there well. Is. A new initiative was filed with the city clerk's office this week by a coalition of advocates for the homeless and low-income folks and advocates for low-income housing. It would create a new public development authority called the Seattle Social Housing Developer, which would be tasked with raising money and building permanently affordable housing in Seattle. The new PDA, that's the Public Development Authority, would be separate from any other local government authority, and it would be slightly different from the old model of public housing represented by the Seattle Housing Authority, which in the last century built affordable housing, but then couldn't manage to raise enough money or obtain enough money from federal, state, and local governments to maintain that housing, and eventually had to sell off large chunks of it to private developers in order to tear down and rebuild rundown housing and replace it with newer units. That was like a two-decade process throughout the 90s and the aughts. And that is pretty much the story of public housing all over the United States in the 20th century. Is in mid-century, public housing was built. It was not maintained. It was allowed to get run down. And then large chunks of it had to be sold off to the private market in order to fund rebuilding the small amount of public housing that is left. Now, instead, the new PDA would be able to build a mix of housing, including units that cater to people that make between 0 and 120% of area median income. This could, by allowing people who make 100% to 120% of median income, this could provide enough of an income stream to pay for the necessary maintenance of that housing long term. And when you have only low income residents or people who are on the very lowest tier of low income residents, those who make 0 to 40% of area median income, you can end up with not enough income coming in to do repairs and long term maintenance. But with a mix of residents, that can give you a bigger pool of funding to make sure that, you know, appliances are replaced. Roofs are repaired, and damage that tenants have done to the walls and to the structures of the building can be fixed when necessary. And then you wouldn't have to keep going back to state and local governments or the federal government and saying, help, we need help, we don't have enough money, you know, 50% of our units are vacant because they're uninhabitable, et cetera, which was an issue with the Seattle Housing Authority. Now, the new PDA is based on a social housing model that's very popular in European cities. I think Vienna is one of the models for this program. Now, one of the interesting aspects of it is the renter-run governing board that would approve the mix of residents who could live there. The initiative doesn't specify a funding source, which means that no taxpayer money is allocated for it, and so there's no requirement that it meet federal HUD regulations like the Seattle Housing Authority has had to do. Federal HUD regulations require you to offer housing only to people who make up to 80% of area median income. So it always put a cap on the income for people who could live in any of the residential units. And so, of course, that also put a cap on the amount of money that the PDA could collect. This doesn't do that. Now, our state and local governments, and even the federal government may decide that they can award grant money to the new PDA anyway, in order to purchase and build new housing the same way they do to nonprofit organizations already. So that could still occur. And the new PDA could also collect private funds from private donors. And more importantly, the new PDA could issue bonds, which a nonprofit developer can't do. And those long-term bonds can not only help fund the purchase and construction of new affordable housing, they can also help with long-term maintenance and things like major repairs, like replacing a sewer line or replacing a roof or something like that. So provided that the paperwork is all in order, the city will issue the initiative a ballot title, and then supporters of the initiative will have to go out and collect about 27,000 signatures this summer for it to qualify for the ballot this fall. And then hopefully, I think 27,000 signatures is a pretty easy thing to do, and I think more people are going to be out and about this summer, so that will be pretty likely that they'll be able to get it on the ballot this fall, and then we'll get a chance to vote on it. So that's the new Seattle Social Housing Developer Initiative. So some good news.
I know they're collecting signatures as we speak at, like, the farmers markets. Taking place. Mm-hmm. So.
I if that gets on the ballot, I wonder what kind of money will be arrayed against it and from what sources.
Yeah, we'll see.
That'll be interesting.
It would be nice if nobody opposed it, but my guess is that we will see private developers saying, hey, no, you know.
Yeah.
The money should go to us.
We can cure everything with market rate housing.
Yeah. By the way, fully fund the police department so that they can jail all the homeless people.
Which
I have to point out is the most expensive way to house homeless people, by putting them in jail. That is not only wrong and criminalize them and makes it practically impossible for them to stabilize their lives and get a job, if they don't already have one. Many homeless people do have jobs. But it is also the most expensive way for
and then they get charged for court costs. People.
Yeah, exactly.
And then they get charged for court costs, which they can't afford, and then warrants get issued for that. And it's just a bad cycle.
Taxpayers spend a lot of money to run the courts and to pay for police. So it is the most expensive way to house poor people. Just saying, yeah. Andy.
By far.
I'm pretty sure that this week, shortly after they started collecting signatures, and speaking of organizations that will align against this, that the King County Housing Authority came out against it this week. Days.
Really?
I'm looking for it right now.
Well, that's
on their site, and I'm not finding it, but it's
that's
where I saw it.
That's the flip side of the coin. There's a limited amount of grant money for affordable housing being issued by the state. And by local governments, there's a perceived to be a limited amount of private money available for it as well. And so some of the other housing authorities, some of the other PDAs around that and nonprofits that are working on this issue may see the new Seattle Social Housing Developer as a competitor. And I have to say, hey, look, we all got to work on this together. Okay, and tearing each other down is not a great idea.
Good luck with that argument.
I know.
But yes, that's a theory. It's a good theory. But our mission is best, and so we have to get as much money for ourselves as possible. So you're a competitor.
Yeah, you're a competitor, and therefore we're going to try to tear you down before you've even tried. Okay, I think that's the wrong way to go.
Yeah.
Right. Well, sticking with government agencies that really have us regular folks in mind when they make their decisions, let's talk about transportation.
Oh, yeah. Changes coming to Metro Transit and Sound Transit. This week, Metro released a report saying that they will be tearing out the old fare boxes on Metro buses and replacing them with a cash-free payment system. Now, currently, people can pay when they board a bus using cash, pre-purchased tickets, or an Orca Transit Pass. But Metro wants to do away with the delay that comes with people paying cash as they board buses. The aging fare boxes are going to need to be replaced, and Metro is now proposing, and they see this as an opportunity to do away with using cash altogether. I can hear you've got an objection, Jav.
Yeah, as somebody who uses cash, yes, I do, because I have never seen any kind of significant delay from people using cash. And it's a relatively small percentage of passengers at this point, which is probably also what they're thinking.
Yeah. Now, before the pandemic, the number of people who used cash to board a bus was about 11%. Not a very big number of riders. During the pandemic, that went up to about 17% of riders currently pay with cash when they board the bus, including, and this is the important thing, a lot of low-income riders, people with disabilities who don't use the bus very often, people who lack access to credit cards, and so they can't easily order an Orca card and refill it when they need to, homeless folks who don't have access to credit or have trouble keeping their belongings. Maybe they had an Orca card at one point, but it was gathered up with all the rest of their belongings in an encampment sweep at one point, and they didn't have the money to get a new one. People who speak English as a second language, who don't know how to get an Orca card. About half of the folks who currently pay with cash don't ride the bus very often, and so they haven't bothered to buy an Orca card, which currently costs about $5 just for the card, and then you have to put some money on it. And that's money that you can't spend on anything else, which can be a real burden on low-income people who are living paycheck to paycheck. Now, and many low-income folks don't qualify for subsidized passes. You have to make less than $27,000 per year to qualify for one, and it helps if you have a permanent address, which many low-income people don't have. That $27,000 per year equates to about $2,250 per month, which barely covers rent in Seattle now.
Let alone, you know, eating.
Let alone food, utilities,
medication.
Clothing, medication, doctor visits, et cetera.
Yeah, all the frivolous extras.
Yeah. All right. Now, many transit advocates have been arguing that Metro should abolish fares altogether, which would mean many more people would park their cars at home and opt to take transit instead. And I have to say that it would be a big win for the environment. All right. We've spent 80 years subsidizing free roads for people to drive on. It's time to start subsidizing free transit instead.
Yeah, and I've got an item on that coming up in a minute, too.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of fares, this week the Sound Transit Board voted on new fare enforcement policies. The outgoing CEO of Sound Transit, Peter Rogoff, was an advocate for heavy fines against people who didn't pay their fares when boarding the light rail line. Under his stewardship, many low-income riders were slapped with $124 fines and court action if they were caught by Sound Transit's security guards. And many folks were banned from riding the light rail and Sound Transit buses altogether. Advocates for the homeless and BIPOC community protested this harsh treatment. In addition to folks who were riding the light rail for the first time, and I also want to point out, folks who ride the light rail for the first time can have some difficulty understanding how to pay the fare. Signage is really poor. There's no conductor or Sound Transit personnel on the train to collect fares, and there's no fare box I think that's the most importantly, there's no fare box on the train where you can pay or buy a ticket when you board. Okay. That's really important. A recent report also showed that fare enforcement disproportionately affects Black riders of Sound Transit. And so there's a question of equity there as well. So this week, the Sound Transit Board, during the pandemic, the Sound Transit Board took the opportunity to suspend fare enforcement and to review the agency's policies to try to come up with a better fare enforcement system. This week, they voted on a new policy that will go into effect September 17th. The new policy will reinstate the $124 fine, but instead of imposing the fine on a first-time offense, a rider will get two warnings within a 12-month period. If caught a third and then a fourth time, they would be levied a $50 fine. For the fifth infraction, the $124 fine kicks in. Okay. And Sound Transit will send unpaid fines to collections, which will once again burden a lot of low-income riders. Now, there's nothing in the new policy that addresses the disproportionate enforcement of Sound Transit's old fare enforcement policy on Black riders, so the new one will likely also be discriminatory. In addition, the new fare ambassadors, as they will be called, will have the authority to ask a person for their ID card, and if their ID card, like their driver's license, et cetera. And if they don't show one, then they can kick that person off the train or the Sound Transit bus. Notably, two people of color who sit on the Sound Transit board voted no on that amendment. Those two people are Seattle Mayor Bruce Harrell and Seattle City Council President Deborah Juarez. Harrell pointed out that the ID requirement is a violation of state law. No kidding. It's also a violation of federal law, especially your right to refuse a warrantless search and seizure. And Harrell pointed out that many people, including immigrants, may choose not to carry their ID with them because they don't want to be deported. Right? Good point. But then King County Council member Dave Upthegrove took the opportunity to beat his chest about the rule of law and civil society. And he called poor people who can't afford to pay and who are uncomfortable submitting to an illegal search and seizure, quote unquote, cheating assholes. Okay. That's Dave Upthegrove for you. And a good reason why he should probably be replaced on the King County Council.
Yeah, and he barely won re-election last year against an immigrant opponent.
Mm-hmm, and you can see why. You can see why. Okay.
Yep. Now, he added also the payment contributes to, quote, the breakdown of civil society.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
I wonder if he has the same attitude about very wealthy people who break the law.
I know.
I'm guessing not.
Not, yeah. Notably, during the pandemic, only about 5% of riders were paying any fares at all. Okay, think about that. Let that sink in. That includes the vast majority of students who were using the light rail line to get to and from the UW and other schools throughout the region. That includes people who were riding the light rail to and from sporting events. Okay, all those Mariners fans, all those Seattle soccer fans, right? That includes tourists. That includes many commuters to their jobs who use the light rail. And it begs the question, why are we even charging fares at all if our goal in building the thing was to get people out of their cars? Again, remember 80 years of subsidizing free roadways for people to drive their cars on. And do we subsidize transit to that extent? No, we don't. And we should be.
Yep.
Now, when asked that question, why not just end fares already? The former CEO of Sound Transit, Peter Rogoff, would always turn up his nose and say something to the effect of, you know, if you don't charge fares, then the light rail trains just get trashy. Right. In other words, when poor people ride transit, and they bring down the neighborhood. Right.
And he also, notably refused to study the funding model and the economic impact of going without fares when community activists would request it to see what the impact on the agency would be.
Yeah, he would just shut them down.
Yeah, since, of course, fare collection actually is a relatively small part of the budget in terms of money they get in from different federal government.
State yeah, government. The highest level it's ever been for Sound Transit is it would pay for about 40%, and usually much less than that. The other side of that coin is that, you know, we can't spend taxpayer money for maintenance on the light rail line. You know, riders have to support it, and that's just ridiculous. Again, drivers don't support maintenance of the roads other than through their tax money. It's a direct 100% subsidy. We need that for inner city public transit as well. Okay. It's a requirement, really, if we're going to survive climate change. In my opinion.
Yep.
And I have to say, really, that's not just my opinion. It's scientific fact at this point. If we're going to survive, we got to do something about our transportation emissions. And the first step is doing away with fares on public transit.
Yeah. And while we're on that topic, I want to talk a little bit about the lawsuit that Attorney General Bob Ferguson filed this week, along with 15 other states. You may remember during the campaign trail and on the beginning of Biden's administration, there was a lot of hoo-ha about we're going to, transition to an all-electric fleet for government vehicles. He got a lot of positive press for that. The lawsuit that was filed by Ferguson and the other AGs is aimed at the United States Postal Service, which is still being run by Trump appointee Louis DeJoy. DeJoy has ordered replacement of 75% of the post office's fleet, which amounts to over 200,000 vehicles. It's a very sizable fleet, as you can imagine. They're getting old and they need to be replaced. So he's replacing them with gas powered replacements as opposed to electric replacements. And,
Not only is he choosing a gas powered alternative, he's basically saying electric vehicles are out of the running in terms of what he'll consider.
Yes. So the lawsuit is alleging that DeJoy violated the National Environmental Policy Act. So they're trying to get the Postal Service on the process, refusing to consider certain alternatives, namely electric-powered vehicles. And that is the basis of the lawsuit with the violation of NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. And it really underscores how difficult it will be to get the kind of institutional change and mindset that, yes, this is a transition away from fossil fuels that we have to make, and we have to make it now. The post office fleet alone would make a huge impact. Number one, it provides incentives to vehicle manufacturers to have vehicles that can compete for that kind of contract, that kind of sale, because it's a huge chunk of money.
And the kind of vehicles that they would be producing are exactly the kind of vehicles, the sort of light trucks and commercial vehicles that we're really going to need in the future for not just, you know, single passenger automobiles that are electric, but also these commercial vehicles that are electric and are heavy duty and can help to transport goods as well as people. That's what you need if you're going to transition your entire national fleet, public and private, to electric in the coming years or to biofuels.
Exactly.
I think it's going to require a mix of electric and biofuels because I don't think we're going to have enough resources to put an electric battery in every single vehicle that needs to be replaced.
If we start mining the asteroids.
Mike.
Talk about expensive, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we can give the contract to Elon Musk and maybe Jeff Bezos.
Yeah.
Says there's going to be pie in the sky for all of us.
Pie in the sky for miners.
Or at least certain minerals, yeah.
So go ahead.
Well, that was just the point that, you know, we need those kind of institutional contracts at a large size. And that's why people were so excited when Biden made the announcement. But Biden doesn't have control of the Postal Service. He's controlled by a Trump appointee who is has ideologically been in the process of making sure the post office is not an institution that anybody cares about anymore.
And can rely on.
Yeah. Sure. Well, yes, exactly.
I have to say in my own job, which involves using the postal service, that we've had to switch to private carriers to ensure that we can get stuff delivered. And that's exactly the goal of someone like Louis DeJoy, to make this public institution unreliable so that people turn to private mail carriers.
Yes, like the ones he has financial interest in.
Yes, exactly, like FedEx. US and UPS.
To pick a totally random example.
Yes.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Moving along, before we jump over to this week's COVID developments, real quickly, there was a settlement this week regarding a police killing.
Yeah, a really bad police killing in September of 2020 in Redmond. This is a woman who called 911 because she was concerned that somebody was trying to kill her. And she didn't realize at the time, of course, that somebody was going to kill her. It was the cop that arrived. So what happened is she was having a mental health crisis of some sort. Police arrive. They ask her if there's any firearms in the house. She says yes, and, you know, goes and retrieves her handgun for them. It's jammed and inoperable, but she does retrieve it and show it to them. And somehow the situation moved from that to her being face down in the hallway outside her apartment, at which point Redmond police officer shot her in the back of the head. Straight up execution. Why this man has not been charged for murder is anybody's guess. Ask Ken Satterberg. But the family of the deceased woman, who's 39 years old, and she had a young son. So her parents, and who are now guardians of the son as well, were getting ready to file a lawsuit. They settled this week with the city of Redmond for $7.5 million. That is divided amongst the lawyer, of course, and the parents, and a trust on behalf of the kid, you know, as he grows up. There's a lot that has not been released about the details of this, how the situation escalated, why she was executed by this officer, and there's really no other word for it. You know, if you've got somebody sitting on your back who just shoots you in the back of the head, and she was unarmed at the time, and clearly unarmed, you know, I have a hard time imagining a scenario where that's a justifiable use of force. I'm sure the Redmond police are busy working on such a scenario. Initially, their press release about the shooting characterized it as, officers were confronted with a handgun and that multiple shots were fired. Neither of those things are true. And we see this pattern over and over where law enforcement agencies just make stuff up, when there's a questionable shooting. Or they're relying on the testimony of the officer and the officer's making stuff up, whatever. It scarcely matters at what point the BS enters the spin cycle. But it also underscores that while we have three different agencies to monitor the behavior of SPD, none of them very effectively, there's very few eyes being cast at oversight of some of these suburban police departments. Certainly Kent got a lot of publicity recently for some of the troubles there. We saw an officer in Auburn being charged with murder earlier this year, and that was the third person that he had shot in the line of duty, shot and killed. So, these suburban law enforcement agencies, I'm sure some of them are run very well, but that does not seem to be the norm.
Yeah, it kind of points to the reason why many of our Washington state legislators, not in this previous legislative session, but last year, had passed landmark police reform legislation. And I think one of the reasons why some of the new freshman legislators of color who joined the state legislature about a year and a half ago are now thinking about not running again for reelection is because in this year's legislative sessions, a bill was passed that pulled the teeth of that landmark police reform legislation. And it can be, I know it can be really hard to see that happen, to pass great legislation in 2021 to just see the 2022 legislative session turn around and undo some of that work. I know that can be really hard to take, but I would urge those legislators to think again about not running for reelection because, you know, it's always baby steps at first. It's always incremental change. And it's important to stay there to push back and to try to get changes made statewide, because making change just in the city of Seattle is not going to cut it. This kind of work has to be done statewide.
Yeah.
And it's not all on them either. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's as a responsibility of as citizens to support them more so yeah. that they aren't, you know, run over by the friggin' bulldozers.
Yeah, by the police unions and by their supporters who, you know, like to send a lot of hate email and spew a lot of damage on social media.
So,
yeah.
All right. Under 10 minutes left. COVID. Any developments this week?
Yeah, the number of new cases in King County continues to increase. It's now at about 800 a day. For reference, in mid-March, it was about 150. So there's a new subvariant that is becoming more common around the country, called instead of BA.2, it's BA.1.12.2 or some.
Yeah, it's hard to keep track at this point.
It really is. I miss the Greek letters, I have to say. Maybe they ran out of them. But the point is that cases are now increasing almost everywhere in the United States. It's worse in Puerto Rico, and that appears to be our future, unfortunately. The BA 12.2, whatever, that one is now about 30% of new cases in the U.S., and that is increasing rapidly. It was only in a few counties in upstate New York as of, you know, 3 weeks ago, and now it's spreading across the country. So I would expect the cases are going to continue to increase. Getting rid of your mask, we keep saying this every week, but it was not a good idea when it was done at the regulatory level, and particularly if you are immunosuppressed or immunocompromised. You know, I would not go into an indoor public space without a mask, or two. So, the pandemic has not gone away. Despite, politicians and businesses, pushing to make us believe that it's all over now and we can go back to quote unquote normal. We're just not there yet. The virus didn't get the memo. So, continue to be vigilant, continue to social distance, continue to wear masks in public spaces, and enjoy the spring.
Hey, I know you've mentioned it before, Jav, that your household is immunocompromised. Do you have a sense for percentage of U.S. that's immunocompromised?
The last number I saw was something like 7 million, which is, you know, maybe 2% of the population, but it's a lot.
Yeah.
But it's still quite a few. And you're also talking about, you know, as people age, their immune systems get weaker. And, you know, people 65 plus is a much larger chunk of the population, especially in Sunbelt states, you know, Florida, Arizona, places like that.
And those let's not forget kids under 5 who can't get the vaccine, and newborn babies who are born immunocompromised until their immune systems fully develop.
That's very true. So, yeah, there's a lot of reasons to particularly wearing masks is particularly effective, N95s if you got them. You know, you're not just protecting yourself, you're protecting the people around you, too. You're protecting your family. You're protecting your neighbors. You're protecting your coworkers, fellow students. You know, there's not signs on people's foreheads saying that they're immunocompromised. They can look perfectly normal otherwise. So you don't know, as you're shopping or doing whatever you're doing, going to a club, whatever, you don't know who's immunocompromised. So protect them, protect yourself, wear a mask.
Yeah. And don't forget, we know that, you can be a carrier of COVID-19 and have no symptoms at all.
And, lest you think, oh, well, that's no big deal. I'll be asymptomatic. You're still at a 30% risk at that point for long COVID, and that's a nightmare. Yeah, there's a lot of reasons to try and avoid getting the virus. It's no joke.
All right. Moving on, only 4 minutes left. Student loans.
President Biden announced this week he's been getting a lot of pressure, particularly from progressive lawmakers in the Democratic Party, to do student loan forgiveness. This is something that Senator Elizabeth Warren has championed. Bernie Sanders has championed it. It's coming from that wing of the party. And he's been saying, well, I'll get around to announcing something. Well, this week he said, an announcement is coming soon, probably in the next couple of weeks. But the one thing he ruled out was something that I think Warren in particular had been asking for, which was $50,000 applied to each student loan. In other words, it would be forgiven to that extent. If you have more than $50,000 in debt, $50,000 would be erased. If you have less, it would be erased entirely. Well, he came out this week and said he's not going to do that, because the poor banks would just take a bath. It'd be terrible.
They would take a haircut.
Is that what he literally said?
They would take a trim.
That's the technical term for when investors who make a bad investment or banks who make a bad loan would have to take a haircut. In other words, they wouldn't get paid back for their bad investment. They would have to write it off as a loss. So, apparently banks never have to take a haircut when it comes to student loan debt.
And those haircuts often don't amount to very much once you get in the tax deductions and all the rest of it. And mind you, the financial sector is one of the most profitable sectors of the economy. And one of the main mechanisms by which money has been moving upward in socioeconomic terms over the past 40 years. The financial sector used to be about 10% of the economy. Now it's over half. That tells you how much money moves through it and how much of a cut they're getting. So that was unfortunate. It appears that the welfare of financial institutions is more important to Biden than the welfare of people trying to overcome student debt, which is unfortunate.
Well, and figuring that he's primarily saying this to try and save the Democrats in the upcoming 2-year elections, you know.
We all know students don't vote, so, you know, it's okay.
We're not talking necessarily about students. We're talking about people who were students 5 or 10 years ago who are still drowning in debt and can't begin their economic lives. In other words, they still can't get a credit card. They can't purchase a house. They can't, you know, get an auto loan.
I know people who have student debt that's 20 years old.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, it's insane.
It is insane.
And student loan debt is actually a bigger number right now than credit card debt in this country. Think about that.
Yeah, and that historically has never been the case. And the fact that it is now just really shows you the abuses in the student loan debt industry. And Elizabeth Warren is right. Something has to be done to make these banks who have issued this debt with terrible terms take a haircut on their bad investments.
And not only terrible terms, but then the debt gets sold and resold and resold. So you don't have one creditor. You might have 5 creditors.
Mm-hmm.
It gets sliced up and sold around in the markets. And, you know, that, as you say, it totally hamstrings people.